Okay, so Dr. Sokolow, of course, needs no introduction. Baruch Hashem, he's been teaching many, really since the beginning, since when you did Iyov, right? That first year when we did Tanakh, the 24 books in Tanakh. That's where I first really was reintroduced to Dr. Sokolow over 3 years ago, and he's taught in the Haftor, he's taught many series. It's always a pleasure to have him. Of course, he's been teaching at Yeshiva University for many years, a prominent author. My daughter, Atara, just told me this morning that your textbook was, or the textbook that he used in the introduction to Bible course at Stern College. So, you didn't even know that yourself, you see? There you go. So anyways.
I don't know, and the publisher says that nobody bought it because he never sent me a check.
Oh, okay. Well, she actually told me she didn't buy the book. She used it in the library and she wants to get the book. How the conversation began. Do you have Dr. Sokolow book? I said, no, I don't have it either. Okay. So that's, anyways, but it's a pleasure. Dr. Sokolow, of course, as you heard, is going to have 2 more weeks of the Haftorah that he's doing for Tishrei Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern. Just a reminder, tomorrow, please God, my share will be at 9:15, not 9:30, 9:15 on the Machzor. And Saturday night, do not forget, Rabbi Liebtag. After Shabbat Shuvah, Rabbi Liebtag will be giving shiur 10 p.m. Eastern, 5 a.m. in Israel. But I don't think we have too many Israelis on right now. Okay, Dr. Sokolow, Bavakasha. This is going to be a packed shiur because he sent 3 source sheets. So I don't know, must be quite a doozy of a shiur we're looking for, Bavakasha.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Just there were different formats, so it was difficult. It was impossible for me anyway to combine them. But it's okay. I take a look now. I actually have 6 screens, but that's okay. Don't worry about it. Okay. All right. So we should start with an introduction to the subject and. Okay, so if you saw the title for this evening's shiur, it was entitled "Sing a Song of 70 or 67 Stanzas." Now, I happen to like alliteration, and it was a curiosity that the 67 and the 70 both start with an S. So I had to change pence into stanzas, only in order to preserve the alliteration. And there aren't really 70 or even 67 stanzas in this week's Sidra, in the Sidra of Ha'azinu. But if we consider each verse to be an independent poetic entity, then we can stretch the meaning of the word stanzas out a little, and we can consider it to actually be a stanza. Okay. So with that, let me just see. I don't know why, for some reason, this on the screen. Let me try once more. Why the screen with the text of Ha'azinu isn't showing up here? Ah, here it is. Okay, good. I got it. All right. So here is the text of Ha'azinu. It comprises the 32nd chapter of the book of you can see it?
Yes. Not yet. It's, I don't know why. It said you started sharing. Yeah, now we can see it. Now we can
okay.
See it.
It takes whatever it is. So it comprises the 32nd chapter of the book of Devarim. It is the penultimate, that is to say, the next to the last sidra in the Torah. And as you can see almost immediately, by the contrast to the surrounding text, it has a very, very distinctive graphic presentation. And that is unlike almost everything else in the Torah, which as the text above it and the text to the right of it are representative, the narrative texts consist of whole lines, whereas the entire, with the text of the poetic portion of the Song of Ha'azinu, consisting of the first 43 verses in the Sidra, right, are written very differently. As you can see, it's written in 2 columns. And the 2 columns facilitate the recognition and the appreciation of Ha'azinu as being a poem, since at least the most striking feature of biblical poetry is called parallelism. And that is that the two parts of a poetic verse have a particular relationship to each other. Now, most of the time, that relationship is that they are repetitive, and that's why the most frequent form of parallelism is called synonymous parallelism. As, for example, the very first verse in this week's Sidra, Ha'azinu Hashamayim, heaven, give ear, Va'adabera, and I will speak, V'tishma Ha'aretz, and let the earth listen to Imrefi, to the words that come out of my mouth. So here basically we have three elements in each half of the verse, and each of those elements are paired off into synonyms. Laha'azin and Lishmoa, both meaning to listen. Perhaps one of them means listen more attentively. We have Shamayim and Aretz, heaven and earth, which are the nouns in direct address in this verse. And then we have the direct object of the verb, which is speech or the words of the mouth. So that's a classic example of what is called synonymous parallelism. And as I said, it is by far the most prevalent form of parallelism. There are, however, instances in which the parallelism actually is one of contrast, and it's called antonymous parallelism. For example, something that comes out of the daily prayer book. Ele varechev ve'ele basusim va'anachnu b'shem Hashem nazkir. Right? There are those who depend upon the might of chariots and those who depend upon the might of their cavalry, whereas we depend upon God. Okay? There, the two halves of the verse are in contrast to each other. Rather than being synonymous, that is to say repetitive, they are antonymous. They cause us to compare or to contrast them. And this continues through almost the entire Song of Ha'azinu. Okay? So as I said, the fact that it's actually structured graphically in this way, in columns, simply makes it easier for us to recognize and to appreciate the poetic nature of it. Just simply for purposes of completeness, there is another poetic segment in the Torah that also has a distinctive graphic presentation, and that's the 15th chapter of the book of Exodus, the Shirat Hayam, the song at the sea, but that's arranged a little differently. That's arranged with, as you see here, it doesn't fill up a whole line. However, neither is it divided into two columns. Rather, what you have is like two short pieces above a lengthy piece, okay? And then again, two short pieces, and below them again, a lengthier piece, okay? The Talmudic Midrashic designation for the graphic format of Ha'azinu is called Ariach al Gabei Ariach, right? A small brick, as it were, placed upon another small brick, while the Shirat Hayam is called Ariach al Gabei Levena, a shorter brick placed upon a longer one. So those are the two outstanding segments of the Torah, outstanding not only because of their poetic nature, but outstanding because they just simply look different than anything else in the Torah. Okay. So this, as you see, it continues throughout the entire 43 verses of the song. This is not the end of the Sidra. There are a few closing verses at the end, and at the end it reverts back to the ordinary narrative form and to the graphic representation of it. Okay. So, because the Song of Ha'azinu is written in this fashion, and because it is so distinctive, it became the hallmark of one of the most, if not the most, well, certainly one of the most famous, no, let me put it this way, probably the most famous, and certainly one of the most important biblical manuscripts. Okay? And it's the one that's known popularly or conventionally as the Aleppo Codex. The word codex itself is just simply a fancy name for a book. Okay? Up to a certain point in history, up to a certain point in the Middle Ages, things were generally written on scrolls. So if you had a long book, right, you could read it, but the pages were sewn together. Now, that meant that you could go very easily from one page to the consecutive page, and you could go backwards easily enough to the preceding page. But if you got to the end of the scroll and you wanted to check something at the beginning of the scroll, then you had no alternative but to simply, and you'll recognize the word, of course, from what we all do with our laptops, you had to scroll all the way back in order to get to the beginning. At some point in time, somebody, and we don't know who it was, somebody finally decided that's, you know, not a particularly easy way of doing things. So instead of taking the individual pages of a scroll and attaching them to one another consecutively, somebody came up with the brilliant idea of taking all of those same pages and putting them one on top of the other and fastening them all together on the side. Fastening them either by sewing them or eventually by placing them, by gluing them together into a binder. And eventually somebody figured out that you really didn't have to do it all with individual pages. If you took a page that was twice the length of an ordinary page and you folded it in half, right, then you actually got four pages out of it. And eventually somebody figured out that you could take four of these folded pages and you could put them together and they were called a choir. That's not the C-H-O-I-R choir, but a Q-U-I-R-E choir. And they would take these choirs and they would take several of them and attach them all together. So that saved time on the binding as well as on the presentation. So that eventually is, that originally was called a codex, and eventually it came to be called a book, or at least it's called a book in English. Okay. In Hebrew, it's a funny thing because in Hebrew, the word sefer is used both to describe a codex, that is to say a book where the pages lie one on top of the other and are bound together on the side. But if you talk about a sefer Torah, then all of a sudden you're using the same word to describe the ancient and early medieval scroll. Okay, so the Aleppo Codex, which is something that we spoke about, some of you may remember, I spoke about it when I was giving a series on Maimonides. And I spoke about it apropos of Maimonides, for the same reason that I'm going to share a different screen with you now that is also apropos of Maimonides. And that is because when Maimonides sat down to write his own Torah scroll, okay, something which is actually not merely recommended, but according to many legal authorities, is required by Torah law. As a matter of fact, it happens to be the 613th commandment of the 613 Torah commandments. Right? It's the mitzvah Taryag of the Taryag mitzvot to write a Torah scroll. And when Maimonides sat down to write his own Torah scroll, he decided that he would follow the scribal practices of the Ben Asher school, and it is in the greatest likelihood the scroll that came to be known, the book that came to be known as the Aleppo Codex, that was the model that Maimonides used for his own Torah scroll. And here I just brought a couple of the consecutive laws in the section of the Mishneh Torah of Maimonides that is called in combination the laws of Tefillin, Mezuzah, and Torah scroll. And he writes that since I have seen great errors in all the scrolls I have examined in this regard, and since the Masoretes, the Balei Mesorah, that is to say the people who were responsible for making sure that we have the correct text of the Torah, the proper consonants, the proper vowels, and the proper punctuation marks, the punctuation marks being called Ta'amei HaMikra, and even though they are perhaps better known or more conventionally known as Trup, as the musical notations, their principal function actually is not musical, but it is grammatical. They are actually punctuation marks.
I don't know if you want to share your screen, but by the way, I mean, I posted on the side, you probably wanted to switch your
I did.
Your
on my end, I did.
No, you didn't.
Whoa.
That's okay. I put it on the side box. It's not the end of the world, but I assumed you wanted to switch it.
Whoa. Did it come up yet?
Now we got it. There you go.
Okay. Sorry, I don't know why my computer seems to be sluggish. Okay. So, in any event, since I've seen great errors in all the scrolls I've examined in this regard, and since the Masoretes who have written on open and sealed portions disagree, as do their source documents, I have seen fit here in the Mishneh Torah to list all the portions of the Torah, sealed and open, okay, the Parashiyot Ptuchot and Setumot, and the form to be taken by the poems, right, the poetic portions, that would be primarily the Shirat Hayam and Ha'azinu, in order to correct all the other scrolls, and so that they may be used for proofreading. And then he goes ahead and he tells us that the book upon which we have relied in these matters is the well-known book in Egypt that contains all 24 biblical books, and that this book, which presently during Maimonides' lifetime apparently was in Egypt, had previously been in Jerusalem, where it was used for proof reading other books. As I said again, this was considered to be the most authoritative consonantal, vocalic, and syntactical text of the Bible. Everyone relied on it. Why? Because it had been proofread by none other than Ben Asher himself, Ben Asher having been the father or the ancestor or the head of a very important school of Masoretes in Tiberias during arguably the 10th and maybe the early 11th centuries, that is to say, perhaps a century before Maimonides' birth, and that Ben Asher himself had examined it minutely over many years and proofed it many times as it has been recorded. And he relied upon this same book of Ben Asher for the purpose of the Torah scroll that he, Maimonides himself, wrote according to halacha. So the question, of course, is it possible for us to identify this book that Maimonides had in Egypt in the 12th century, a book that had previously been in Jerusalem and that had originally been in Tiberias? Is it in fact one and the same with the book that eventually ended up in the city of Aleppo in Syria, hence the name the Aleppo Codex? So, as I note here, current scholarship posits that the well-known book to which Maimonides was referring is none other than the Aleppo Codex, known in Hebrew as the Keter, the crown of Aram Tzova, the biblical name for Aleppo, a fully vocalized and punctuated manuscript of the entire Tanakh that reposed for an extended period of time in the Syrian city of Aleppo, to which it was brought in the 14th century by David HaNagid, a descendant of Maimonides. So indeed, it would seem that this scroll was in the possession of the Maimonides family, and that about 100 years after Maimonides' death, the political situation in Egypt changed, and many Jews felt that it was necessary to leave the country, to emigrate. And one of the members of the family of Maimonides emigrated from Cairo to Aleppo and brought this important family heirloom along. It was thought to have been destroyed during the anti-Jewish riots of 1948, but a good deal of it was subsequently resurfaced and has since been published in a facsimile edition with a portion on display in the Israel Museum Shrine of the Book alongside the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, Maimonides said that he followed the Aleppo Codex in two regards. First of all, he said in regard of which parashiyot, which portions within the Torah are open or closed. An open portion means that the previous portion ended in the middle of a line, and the following portion did not begin until the beginning of the next line. A closed portion means that the preceding portion ended in the middle of a line, and the subsequent portion began on the same line after a space. Okay? So one way we could confirm that Maimonides used the Aleppo Codex is by going through the laws in the Mishneh Torah, in which Maimonides lists all of the open and all of the closed portions and see if they conform to it. Another way is, and that's the one that's in the next text below, and that is that Maimonides said that he also followed the Aleppo Codex in regards to the poetic portions of the Torah. Now, there is nothing particularly unique or distinctive about the Aleppo Codex's presentation of the Shirat Hayam, not to mention parenthetically that it's not accessible. It wasn't accessible for a very, very long time. The people who were its guardians in Aleppo were very jealous of it and rarely allowed outsiders to see it and almost never allowed it to be copied. Okay. Curiously, one exception is that in the late 19th, probably early 20th century, somehow or another, there was an Anglican bishop who did some favors for the Jewish community in Aleppo in exchange for the permission to photograph a portion of the Aleppo Codex. And the curious thing is that the portion that he photographed consisted of, right, the portion of Ha'azinu. So even though the rest of the Aleppo Codex was inaccessible for a very long time, and even to this very day, it is largely inaccessible to the general public, okay, the portion of Ha'azinu was actually published. So here's a curious thing. How many lines of poetry are there in Deuteronomy 32? So if you see here in the continuation of this same section of the Mishneh Torah, the laws of Tefillin, Mezuzah, and Torah scroll, Maimonides writes that the form of the Song of Ha'azinu was as follows. Every single line has a space in its middle equal to that of a sealed portion. As I said, the space that would be between the preceding and subsequent portions if they were stumot, if they were sealed, okay? So that every line is divided in half. And that's exactly what we saw in the opening slide. Now, as to how many lines there are, Maimonides writes, or at least in this text, it says, V'kotvin ota b'shiv'im shitot. That's the highlighted words in Hebrew. It is written in 70 lines. And then he actually goes ahead and he says, these are the words that begin each of the lines. Okay? So be very simple. Since I told you that we have a photographic copy of the Song of Ha'azinu in the Aleppo Codex, we should just simply be able to count the number of lines and to confirm that indeed it is the Aleppo Codex that Maimonides was following. So here we go. Let me get a different screen up here and share the Aleppo Codex with you. Okay. Let's see here. Aleppo Codex. I've got to close this and reopen it. And voila. Okay. Here, folks, is the Aleppo Codex. This is really it. Okay. You can see again on the upper right hand side and the bottom left hand side, that's the usual format of a Torah scroll. Okay. And in, you know, the better part of three columns, okay, three folio pages, we have in matching columns the Song of Ha'azino. So how many lines are there in Ha'azino? I decided not to have you sit there and try to count it all, so I just simply went ahead and I marked off every 10th line. Okay? So clearly if you start on the right-hand page, 10, 20, then go to the middle page, 30, 40, then go to the left-hand page, 50, 60. Now you can count past 60. How many lines are there past 60? Well, if you paid attention to the title of this evening's shiur, you really didn't have to count them because there are 67 lines. Okay? There's no question about it. There's absolutely no way to confuse it. Okay? It is empirical. It is objective. There are 67 lines. So, folks, if Maimonides wrote in the Mishneh Torah that the Song of Ha'azinu occupies 70 lines, and it is perfectly obvious in the Aleppo Codex that the Song of Ha'azinu occupies only 67 lines, then could the Aleppo Codex have been Maimonides' guide for his Torah scroll? No.
No.
Okay. But it was the guide for his Torah scroll. In which case, what option is left to us logically? Well, if we can't change the Aleppo Codex, how about if we change the text of Maimonides? So, indeed, as you can read now, a singular contribution to the identification of the Aleppo Codex as the book that was consulted by Maimonides was made by late professor of Bible and Hebrew at the Hebrew University, Moshe Goshen Gottstein, who used really simple logic. You remember the famous line that Sherlock Holmes, right? If you eliminate the impossible, then what is left, no matter how improbable, is probably the truth. So what he did is, since he was absolutely sure, on the basis of a variety of different evidence, particularly his examination, minute examination of all of the Masoretic notations in the Aleppo Codex and comparing them to Maimonides, that it was indeed the Aleppo Codex that Maimonides consulted, then how could Maimonides have made such a tremendous, such an obvious mistake in terms of the number of lines? So he came to the only obvious conclusion. And the only obvious conclusion is that the text of the Mishneh Torah was wrong, and that Maimonides had originally written that there were 67 lines in Ha'azinu, but because the Aleppo Codex was unknown in most of the Jewish world, and certainly unknown in any part of the Ashkenazic Jewish world, the manuscripts on which they relied had the Song of Ha'azinu presented in 70 lines. So at some point in the transmission of the text of the Mishneh Torah, either a copyist or a printer saw something in Maimonides where he said that the Song of Ha'azinu was 67 lines and said, wait a second, I'm a Bal Koreh and I can tell you that's a mistake. And he opened up his own Sefer Torah and said there are 70 lines. So he decided that there must have been a mistake in his copy of the Mishneh Torah. So he corrected the text of the Mishneh Torah, changing the original 67 to an erroneous 70. And indeed, as I can show you here, if you go to a critical edition of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah that was edited by the late Rabbi Yosef Kafach, who in his lifetime was one of the chief rabbis of the Yemenite Jewish community, and who based his text of the Mishneh Torah on Yemenite manuscripts. And as we again mentioned in a previous series on Maimonides, his relationship to the Jews of Yemen was such that they revered him to such an extent that there are texts of Kaddish in Yemenite Sidurim, which makes specific mention of Maimonides. Right? That when people recited Kaddish for their loved ones, they referred to Maimonides because he was so beloved of the Yemenite Jewish people. And on the basis of his examination of these manuscripts, he produced an improved text of the Mishneh Torah. And you can read in his text of the Mishneh Torah that it says, V'kotvin ota b'sheva v'shishim shitot. Okay. So much for the Song of Ha'azinu in terms of its graphic presentation in the Torah. What I want to show you very quickly now is just something, a curiosity. Wrong screen. Again, I think I have to open it here.
No, you have a new screen up now.
No. I have to, as I said again, I don't know why the computer this evening is acting up. Don't we always blame the computers when it's really ourselves? Here we go. Just to show you again the impact, the influence of the Song of Ha'azinu. I took here, not randomly, I grant you that, the first chapter in the book of Isaiah. Okay? I chose it, not randomly, okay, because of its opening verse, not verse one, which is simply informational. It tells us who the prophet was and when he lived and where he lived. But beginning with verse two, which is the beginning of the prophecy. And if it resonates with you, Shim'u shamayim v'ha'azini eretz ki Hashem diber. Obviously, it is a variation on the theme of Ha'azinu Hashamayim Va'ada Beira V'tishma Ha'aretz Imre Fi. And to simply show that it wasn't only the opening verse in Ha'azinu that influenced the choice of language on the part of the prophet Isaiah, I highlighted additional phrases or passages in just this first chapter of the book of Isaiah that also resonate with key verses or phrases in the Song of Ha'azinu. Okay? So indeed, as I said, this is just simply an indication of how powerful the Song of Ha'azinu was, that it continued to resonate so much with later Jewish authors and poets. Okay. What I want to do with the balance of the time is I want to look a little bit of the text. And I decided that we would look together at the opening verse and at almost the closing verse. And that we'd look at it through the eyes of a early modern Bible commentator. So I'm going to share with you now, if in fact I can get the right screen up here.
Okay. I think it's the one you had before, right? Because that's the one you shared with me.
Yes, this one. Okay.
Yeah.
Is it
okay.
Right now? Yeah. Yay. Okay. Let me give you a very brief introduction to the Kli Yakar, a precious vessel. The author of the Kli Yakar was Rabbi Shlomo Ephraim Lunshitz. He lived in Poland and in Bohemia. He was born in 1550 and he died in Prague in 1619. He was a student himself of the Maharshal, Rabbi Shlomo Luria. And the last 15 years of his life, he was the Av Beit Din, the head of the local rabbinic court in the city of Prague. Okay, no mean feat, since during the 16th and 17th centuries, Prague was led by such luminaries as the Maharal of Prague, etc. So clearly he was in in good company. And to be in that company, he had to have been a man of considerable scholarship himself. But in addition to his Jewish legal scholarship, he was considered in his lifetime and has been so regarded ever since as one of the most outstanding darshanim ever in Jewish history. That is to say that he was a homilist. He delivered homilies. He delivered drashot. And he was unsparing and unstinting in giving criticism to anyone whom he thought was deserving of it, regardless of what their station or position was in life, which may explain why until the last 15 years of his life, he moved around quite a bit because he seems to have given offense to people in many of his previous congregations. He was critical, if he thought it was necessary, of his fellow rabbis, whom he would occasionally accuse of arrogance. He was critical of rich people, wherever they were, whom he accused of not tending to the needs of the community and specifically to the needs of their less rich brethren. In fact, one of my favorites of his homilies, he took a Torah verse in which Lavan and Betuel give a bracha, blessing to Rivka before they send her off to marry Isaac. And their blessing to her is Achotenu, little sister, At Hayila Alfei Revava, right? Using a form of hyperbole, of exaggeration, may you become multitudes. Okay? Lunschitz, the author of the Kli Yakar, put those words, as it were, into the mouths of the rich people, of his contemporary wealthy people, having them, as it were, pick up, let's say, the equivalent of a dollar bill, and say to the dollar bill, Achotenu at, right? You're my little sister. Hayila alfei revava. Go out there and turn yourself into thousands and millions of dollars. Okay. In addition to collections of his sermons, which were published, by the way, by no less a prestigious publishing company than the Va'ad Arba Aratzot, the Council of the Four Lands, okay, he also wrote this Torah commentary called the Kli Yakar, which to a very large extent actually qualifies as a super commentary, that is, a commentary on the commentary of Rashi. That is why his commentary on the opening verse of Ha'azinu is directed to Rashi's commentary. So let me share with you a moment the text of Rashi's commentary to better understand the presentation or the problem that the author of the Kli Yakar detected in the text of Rashi. So on the top, and if don't have to strain your eyes because I copied it out, is actually a fragment of one of, if not the oldest surviving manuscript of Rashi's commentary on the Torah. It has been dated reliably to the early part of the 13th century and not as reliably to the end of the 12th century, which means that it's conceivable that it was written within a century of Rashi's death. Okay? And it reads as follows, and if you want to try to follow along in the manuscript, you're welcome to, but the text in Hebrew is below it, okay? Hazinu HaShamayim, what does Moses want heaven and earth to listen to? Shanim matre bahem liYisrael, that Moses, as it were, was issuing a warning to the people of Israel. And since he was warning them, there had to be witnesses to the warning. And heaven and earth were to witness this warning. Because at the end of last week's Torah reading, Moshe said, Va'aida bam et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz. I will summon heaven and earth as witnesses. So here it is now. He's summoning heaven. B'chein tishma ha-aretz. He's summoning heaven and earth to be witnesses. V'lama ha'id bahim shamayim v'aretz. Why did he choose heaven and earth to be witnesses? Amar Moshe. Moses said as follows. Ani basar v'adam. I'm mortal. L'machar ani meit. Right? And that almost literally so, right? That so shortly I'm going to pass away. Imroyu Yisrael, if the Jewish people one day should argue, lo kibalnu aleinu brit, covenant with God, never heard of it. Okay? Mi ba'u makhishan, who is going to be able to come and to contradict them? Therefore, lefichach, he'id bahem edim shehem kayamim la'olam. He had to choose witnesses who exist in perpetuity, who could testify to the covenant and would still be able to offer that testimony in the distant future if necessary. Okay. That makes sense. Now, obviously, this is only in a highly symbolic sense. Okay. Therefore, because perhaps it's highly symbolic and Rashi is looking for perhaps something a little more tangible, he offers what appears to be an alternative, va'od, moreover, okay? An additional reason, a further reason. See, I highlighted the word va'od, and because, as you'll see in the text of the Kli Yakar, it's very significant. Meaning, another reason why Moses chose heaven and earth is not just because they exist in perpetuity, but because she'im yizku, because if Israel is meritorious, and they deserve to be rewarded, right? Yavo ha'edim halalu v'yitnu secharam. Then the witnesses will be the instruments through which their reward will be delivered to them. Namely, ha'gefen titen piriya, va'aretz titen yivula, that is, the earth will be fruitful, ha'shamayim yitnu talam, and the heavens will provide rain. And on the other hand, mitchayvu, if the Jews are found guilty, right, of neglect of the Torah, Yad ha'idim tiyeh bam tchilas. Torah law requires the witnesses have to participate in the delivering of the punishment. And therefore, v'yatzarat ha'shamayim, the heavens will no longer give rain. Ha'adama lo titen et yivula, and the earth will no longer be fruitful. Okay. So the question that the Kli Yakar addresses himself to is, are these two separate reasons for why Moses chose heaven and earth to be witnesses? Or are they really only two sides of the same reason? And the reason that I highlighted the word va'od in the text of Rashi is simply because in the Kli Yakar's text of Rashi, the word was written differently. You can see I highlighted it now in a different color. You see, just after it says, because these are witnesses, shekayamim la'olam, that they exist in perpetuity, the next word is not va'od she'im yizku, moreover, or additionally, if Israel is meritorious. The word is spelled vav ayin dalad, which means you could read it as va'od. On the other hand, you could read it together with the previous word as Shehem kayamim la'olam va'ed. In which case, it makes a seamless transition from what would otherwise be one reason to another reason. So instead of being two separate but related reasons, it turns out, as I said, to be one seamless reason from start to finish. Now, why is this significant? Let's look at the continuation. Okay. He continues and he says that it's possible to reconcile these two readings, meaning to determine what the relationship is between the perpetual existence of heaven and earth on the one hand and the fact that they can be instrumental either in rewarding Israel or in punishing them. And the reconciliation, he says, is as follows. The Fisham Rurazal, sages tell us, that does the Torah refer to the sixth day of creation as Yom HaShishi with a definite article, while all of the preceding days have no definite article? They say because HaShishi, the sixth day, is an allusion to the sixth day of the month of Sivan, which of course is the holiday of Shavuot, the day on which the Torah was written. So the sages come up with the following homily. And the homily is, you see it on the second line, Im yekablu Yisrael ha-Torah, if Israel eventually, right? That is from the time of creation, it was like, you know, 2,000 years, you know, off, okay? If Israel will eventually accept the Torah, mutav, then everything will be fine and well. V'im lo, if however Israel rejects the Torah, yachzor ha'olam letohu vavohu, then creation, as it were, will revert to chaos. Okay. Now, that means heaven and earth will no longer exist. Now, if you take a look out the window, right, heaven and earth are still in existence. If heaven and earth are still in existence, then what does that prove? It proves that Israel has been, right, has been keeping the Torah. Because if God's threat was that if Israel rejects the Torah, everything will revert to chaos, and everything has not reverted to chaos, then ipso facto, Israel has been keeping the Torah. As he says, continuing there in the third line, Me'achar she'anu ro'im ka'ayom she'shamayim ba'aretz ka'yamim, v'lo huchzuru l'tohu v'avohu, as I said, zeh mofet, what is this evidence of, proof of? Mofet choteh, right? This is demonstrable evidence that she'kiblu Yisrael ha'Torah. But not only did Israel accept the Torah historically at Mount Sinai on that sixth day of Sivan 3,000 years ago and change, right? But they have been keeping it ever since. And you see the highlighted passage, Ki kiyumam, the continued perpetual existence of heaven and earth, notain edot Hashem ne'manah, offers veritable evidence, Shekvar kiblu Yisrael et ha-Torah, that the Jewish people is consistent in their observance of the Torah, or at least on the whole, they seem to be more in observance of the Torah than in neglect of it. And he continues and he says, essentially the existence of heaven and earth is dependent upon the Torah. Now, why should the existence of heaven and earth be dependent upon the Torah? He says, because both that which is celestial, right, represented by heaven, and that which is terrestrial, represented by earth, are opposites, okay? And opposites require an intermediary to connect them. And who is the intermediary between heaven and earth? The intermediary between heaven and earth is man. Why? Because man is a hybrid of matter, right, what he calls chomer, matter, and tsura, form or shape. And this hybrid, this combination, right, how does man keep his terrestrial body and his celestial soul together? He keeps them together through observance of the Torah. Without Torah, he writes, man would be no more than an animal and would have no share in the celestial. Therefore, any person who engages in Torah is reconciling the celestial and the terrestrial and preventing them from opposing one another through his combination of them. In other words, he writes, he, the Torah, is makom denashke ara v'rakia. Torah, as it were, is the place where heaven and earth meet. I'm going to jump now to the very end of the Song of Ha'azinu, where God says of himself, Ani amit va'achaye, I take life, I grant life, machatzti, I can inflict pain and suffering on people, va'ani erpa, and I can cure them, ve'ein miyadi matzil, and no one can escape heavenly judgment. And he has a rather interesting comment to make on this too, and with that we will conclude. And he says as follows. He says that when the verse speaks of God taking life and giving life, okay, it's not just talking about the fact that people are born because God wants them to be born, and eventually those people die because God, you know, wants them to die. It's not simply a description, as it were, of the cycle of life. He says, and he follows in this respect in the Talmudic reading of the text, that this is an allusion to Tchiyat HaMetim, an allusion to the resurrection of the dead in the eschatological future. Talmud says, Tchiyat HaMetim in HaTorah Minayin, is there in fact a Torah verse that describes resurrection? And it says, yes, the verse is, Ani Amit Va'achayeh. Now what's the proof that it's not simply a description of the cycle of life? See what I'm doing? Right? The international sign for Ifcha Mistabra, right? Because of the sequence, right? If it were described in the ordinary cycle of life, it should say Ani Achayeh V'Amit. Then he could be talking about one and the same person. Person is born, and eventually person dies. Since it says Ani Amit V'Achayeh, since it puts the taking of life prior to the granting, to the bestowal of life, it's obviously talking about the granting of life, not at birth, but the granting of life at the moment of Chiyat HaMetim, at the moment of resurrection. But he takes it a step further. And the step further to which he takes it is by saying that this is not merely a reference to Chiyat HaMetim, which will take place when it does on an individual level. That is to say that individual people who were once alive and subsequently died, because that's the way of the world, will ultimately come to life again. He sees it as a depiction of the fate of the corporate entity of the Jewish people. And he says something very interesting. He says that the future, that it is a symbol, not just of Tchiyat HaMetim, but as he calls it in the Hebrew, it is an allusion to the Geula Ha'atida, to the future redemption of the Jewish people. And he says that this redemption, tiye kfula, it will be a dual kind of a redemption, geula gufanit, a physical redemption, and a geula nafshit, a spiritual redemption. Just as he said previously, that heaven represents, the celestial represents that which is spiritual, and the earth represents that which is physical. And it is the function of man and the Torah to keep them from being in opposition to each other, but rather working in tandem with each other. He uses the same idea to talk about the future redemption of the Jewish people as consisting of both a physical redemption and a spiritual redemption. The physical redemption, he says, is the release from oppression on the part of the Gentile nations. That is to say, the restoration of Jewish national sovereignty. And the spiritual redemption, he says, is the subjugation of the evil inclination. Therefore, he says, when God says, Ani Amit, I will take life away, that, he says, is represented by the fact that we are in exile. That is Galut. Galut, on a national level, is the equivalent of physical death of a human being. And when God promises that after the Ani Amit, there will yet be Ani Achayeh, there will be a restoration of life, then that, he says, is a sign that the Jewish national being will be resurrected as well, that there will be an end to the Galut, and there will be an era of Geula. And he brings another verse to confirm it, a verse that says, "Bayom hashlishi nichye v'na'amod lefanav," on the third day, right, there will be a revival. So he says, what is the third day? The third day is an allusion to the third redemption. The first redemption, of course, was the redemption from bondage in Egypt. The second redemption was the redemption from the Babylonian exile. The third redemption is the one that we still await and anticipate. So, with that, I will hope that I was able to share with you somewhat of the totality of Ha'azinu on the one hand, and a little bit of its particularity on the other hand. I have a quick look at the, Dr. Goshen Gottstein was somebody's, well, I know you, I was very fortunate in being able to take classes with him at the Hebrew University when he was still teaching and still lecturing. So that means that, of course, you're an uncle to Alon Goshen Gottstein, whoever this is. Significant and important scholar and activist in his own right.
It's very nice of you to mention Alon. This is Gershon Hepner, yeah.
I know that he's also a controversial figure, but that's okay. I'm on his side. Okay. In the format of Shirat Hayim, so passing between the sides, oh, that's nice. I've never read that any place. This is excellent. If this is original, you should find some venue in which to publish it. I've never seen this. The idea somehow of the graphic representation being somewhat of I love it. I love it. That you can see Bnei Yisrael passing between the sides of the sea, that they're in the middle and the sea is above and below them. And Hazinu, you see the heavens on one side, the earth on the other. I love it. Fantastic.
Thank you. So
you've made my evening and maybe my weekend too.
Thank you.
Rabbi, back to you.
Okay, yes, I also like that comment very much. I agree. Very interesting and original. Okay, thank you, and thank you for the shiur. Hazina is a very difficult parsha, of course, and Yasher Koach, thank you. Look forward to learning with you. As I say, Dr. Sokolow will be Tuesday doing the Haftorah of Simchat Torah and Shmini Atzeret.
I should say one thing, Rabbi. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Ha'azinu. I could talk about it for weeks, but I don't really think that the audience would really be interested in the commentary on Ha'azinu of the famous Jerusalem 10th century Kara'at Yefet Ben Eli.
Probably not, but I did not know that. I love the Kli Yakar because he was, you know, you say a moralist, a sermani, you called him a darshan, but, you know, and yes, he, I haven't seen his criticism, I'm not that familiar with his papers, but I haven't seen his criticism of the rabbis as much as I do of the wealthy people. That's all over the place, criticizing the Zahav as all the wealthy people, and whatever, but, and of course, you're right. Prague was Ir Ve'em Yisrael. I've often said the what we call the Malraw Shul, the Altnai Shul in Prague, is the most prestigious shul in all of Jewish history. There is no shul in the world that has had the rabbinic elite that the Altnai Shul has had. Dr. Sokol, if you disagree, I'd like to hear, but I do not believe any shul in Jewish history has had this succession of Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael as that Altnai Shul in Prague.
I will not disagree for no less reason, although there are certainly greater reasons than the fact that I actually can trace my my genealogy back to the Shalom.
Uh-huh. Okay. The Behuda, of course, was there. I mean, the Tosfot Yontif. I mean, one after another of Gedolei Yisrael served.
And they're all in the family.
They're all in what? In your family?
Yeah.
Okay, very nice. You come to it honestly, but it really was Prague was Ir Ve'em Yisrael. For those who've been, it's not such a big shul, but it's probably the most moving davening I ever had in my life on a Friday night when I was there. I just felt like knowing about the history of the shul. It was such a powerful davening there. But anyway, okay, nunu. Okay, thank you very much. Tomorrow morning, like I say, I'll be giving my shiur on the Matzor at 9:15 a.m. Eastern. Saturday night, 10 p.m., Rabbi Liebtag. No shiurim Sunday or Monday for obvious reasons, but we want to wish everybody a Gemar Chatima Tov, all a wonderful year, and God should hear our prayers for good. And okay, thank you very much. Everybody have a Laila Tov and Shabbat Shalom, and hope to see you before if we can. And okay, thank you.
Gemar Chatima Tova.
Yeah, be well, everybody. Thank you.